A number of economists have made the case that following the commodity boom of the early part of the previous decade, the recent past in Latin America has seen a sharp deceleration of economic growth. A colleague of mine, Moises Naim, put it this way. He said, against the backdrop of stagnating wages and rising cost of living, indignities such as inequality and corruption have become more difficult for many people to swallow. I would like to share with you some reflections on what are some of the areas where we could focus as we search for solutions in coming years to address the problems of Latin America. And in particular, I wanted to identify six areas, six factors. Number one, I think we need to take inequality much more seriously than we have done so far. Governments need to move more aggressively to reduce income inequality. This will mean more proactive use of tax policies and the budget as an instrument of distribution. This is what European Union members have been doing for the past several decades in a clearly deliberate way. Of course, this is easier done when governments are credible and citizens and the business community are convinced that higher taxes will not be stolen or otherwise wasted, but will be reflected in better schools, better quality infrastructure, improved public services, and so on. The European Union has a formal mechanism embedded in European Union law which channels resources from members with higher incomes to members with incomes below the European Union average. These resources are channeled through the European Union budget and have had vast implications for the poorer members. When Spain and Portugal joined the European Union in 1986, they were poor in relation to the more established members, and they began to receive close to 5% of GDP on an annual basis as structural funds and other inflows, which, within a generation, literally transformed and helped modernize the Spanish and Portuguese economies. Latin America regrettably does not have in place such an ambitious program of economic and political integration and has paid a very heavy price for not creating an integrated economic space that might lead to economies of scale and improved efficiency. I will come back to this issue in a few minutes. Second, I think we need to improve the structure of government spending. Whatever revenue is collected needs to be better deployed. The problems here are multiple and insidious. In some countries, too much money spent on wasteful government subsidies, which, in the case of energy, go largely to benefit the upper-income groups who drive their cars in polluted cities and own the bigger houses. Subsidizing energy worsens income distribution and accelerates climate change. It is, in fact, an idiotic public policy, followed gleefully in many countries in the region, with huge opportunity costs in terms of schools not built, hospitals not modernized, old age pensions not boosted to more dignified levels. Other countries have tied their hands in senseless ways by embedding in their laws various, sometimes seemingly well-meaning restrictions on the structure of spending, which seriously limit the ability of governments to redirect resources to more productive, enhancing areas. Instead of, for example, generous pensions for the military, who in many countries can retire at an unusually young age given life expectancy levels. Latin American countries spend annually $64 billion in their various military establishments, and that in a region of the world where the last major interstate conflict took place more than 80 years ago, the Chaco War between Bolivia and Paraguay in the 1930s. The IMF calls military spending unproductive expenditures to highlight the well-known fact that there is not much to be gained by, say, modernizing the Air Force, when airplanes will actually hardly ever be used, other than to occasionally impress the populations on National Independence Day and the associated military parades. More countries should imitate Costa Rica, where military spending is zero, and the government instead has focused on human capital development and, yes, having a well-trained police force to enforce the law, deter crime, and ensure appropriate levels of safety within national borders. Third, more rule of law. We in Latin America have a mistaken understanding of this concept. At various times and to various people, rule of law has meant any of a number of things, including government bound by law, equality before the law and order, the presence of a predictably efficient system of justice, and the existence of a state that safeguards human rights. Some have argued that the concept is linked to notions of liberty and democracy, necessarily implying constraints on the power of the state and guarantees of basic freedoms for citizens, such as speech and association. In this view, the rule of law has elements of political morality and is very much a foundation for a just society. It is certainly inseparable from the morality underpinning contemporary democracy, with its emphasis on the protection of individual rights, including those of free expression, voting, and the right to private property. In Latin America, however, our politicians have generally taken a much narrower view. Instead of asking ourselves whether the laws are of general application, are well known to the affected parties, are understandable, not subject to internal contradictions, not applied retroactively, not subject to frequent and arbitrary changes, we have instead interpreted the rule of law to mean the rule by law, meaning that there is no presumption of government subordination to the law, which is seen as a vehicle not to limit its power, but rather to serve its purposes. This is what some authoritarians mean when they talk about the dictatorship of the law. That is, the government may do as it pleases. People in the region, particularly the young, may not be able to articulate these distinctions precisely, but they readily recognize abuse when they see it, such as during rigged elections, for instance, and are no longer willing to tolerate it. Going out to the streets to remind politicians that insulting the people's intelligence is not a recipe for good governance will be an increasingly frequent tool to promote social and political change. Next, we need to empower women. This may surprise some, but the fact remains that the region, while not the worst performer in the world in terms of its treatment of women as second-class citizens, is still very much a male-dominated culture where much remains to be done in terms of the political and economic empowerment of women. In Brazil, the largest country in the region with a population of in excess of 200 million people, only 15% of the members of parliament are women. The presence of women on the boards of publicly listed companies is likewise pitifully small. The issue here is not just one of justice and opportunity, it is also one of economic efficiency, as there is overwhelming empirical evidence that educating and empowering women has multiple benefits for productivity and economic growth. We need to tackle corruption. I will not review here the utterly destructive consequences of corruption, as there is an extensive literature on the subject. But it is clear that there is profound discontent in the region with this particular lethal form of economic and social cancer. In his magnificent book on bribery and corruption, John Noonan said that the damage inflicted by corruption goes beyond any material measurement. When government officials act to enrich themselves, they act against the fabric on which they depend. For what else does government rest upon except the expectation that those chosen to act for the public welfare will serve that welfare? Furthermore, bribery and corruption are deeply at odds with the moral basis of most of the world's great religions, which have often provided the moral underpinnings of the modern state. Anti-corruption strategies have to be supported by moral education and the strengthening of the ethical principles underpinning society. This may mean reinforcing the civic responsibility component of secular education. It may require religious leaders to set aside narrow doctrinal differences and return to the spiritual roots of their respective faiths to revitalize their ability to lead individuals and societies to a stronger identification with the spiritual rather than the material dimensions of human nature. In particular, it will involve partnerships with all the organizations and social forces that have a strong ethical foundation. In a society with strong ethical standards, the struggle against corruption will gain a new source of strength that will complement the progress made in recent years in improving the legal framework designed to combat bribery and corruption. And the sixth area that I want to focus some attention on is a new idea to revitalize Latin America. Against the background of the chaos and the destruction of World War II, the nations of Europe came together and founded the European Community in 1957. Initially intended to strengthen international cooperation and create an enlarged economic space free of restrictions to the flow of goods and services, in time, the European Community evolved into the most important experiment in economic and political integration and gave rise to the largest trading bloc in the world. The process has not been smooth, and progress in some areas has sometimes been followed by setbacks in others. But there is little doubt that, in a longer-term perspective, the experiment has been remarkably successful. 15 of the 30 countries in the world with the highest income per capita are members of the European Union. Latin America would benefit greatly from greater economic integration, from freer mobility of the factors of production, from creating an enlarged economic space where synergies and complementarities could be exploited to improve productivity and efficiency, as opposed to being a chaotic collection of sovereign states competing with each other and often acting at cross-purposes. The European Union evolved gradually. Its first decade was largely characterized by the gradual elimination of tariffs on intra-European trade. Supranational institutions, a European Parliament passing law binding on its members, was decades away. But the idea of a united Europe was a powerful cohesive force. And for prospective new members, for instance, countries in Central and Eastern Europe in the late 1980s after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and thereafter, serve as an effective catalyst for change and modernization. And as noted earlier in our discussion of inequality, a powerful mechanism for convergence, the narrowing of income gaps between countries. Without an exciting new vision of economic revival, the region is likely to continue to be gripped by the malaise alluded to earlier. This will be bad for Latin America's 641 million citizens and, in an increasingly interdependent world, bad for the rest of the world as well.